Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 140, Smorgasbord, July 2019. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking and getting in the kitchen, having more fun, learning new things, all that good kind of stuff. And well, today I have a smorgasbord episode for you, which means we're going to be covering a lot of different topics. Not one overarching theme for today's episode, but several things I want to touch on. I want to talk about a new grill I got for my birthday / Father's Day. I've got some listener feedback on the outdoor cooking episode that I had with Carl here a couple of episodes back. I want to share a little bit about that. Also had some listener questions about cooking with nuts, so we're going to cover some of that today too. So yeah, we got a few things to tackle. Before I get into any of that, though, of course, I need to do a little bit of housekeeping. As usual, the episode notes, the show notes for today's episode, rather, are going to be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/140. kitchencounterpodcast.com/140 will get you to the show notes, and any links or things like that I mentioned in today's episode, I will put over there so you can find them nice and easy. If you want to get in touch with me, you know, I love getting feedback and having listeners say hello. And the easiest way to do that is to shoot me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. But if that's not your jam, you can always go find me on Twitter @TKC Podcast. You can head over to our Facebook group, the Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. Easiest way to find that is just to go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group, and it will take you to a link. You can hop over and join the group. Lots of cool people talking about good food-related and cooking-related stuff in there. So if you just want to say hi, or you have a question you want me to cover on a show, or ideas for upcoming topics to cover, send me an email or reach out over on Twitter or Facebook. That would be awesome. I love to hear from each and every one of you, and I try to read and respond to everybody that I can. So anyway, yeah. All right, let's jump into it. Smorgasbord, July 2019. Well, first things first, I want to mention friend of the show, Mason Hutchinson, over at the Herb Rally podcast. He belongs to the Facebook group, and he's emailed me back and forth a few times. We've been corresponding on email over the past several months. And his podcast, Herb Rally, is all about herbs and herbalism and the nutritional value of using herbs and spices and herbal medicine and stuff like that. He asked if he could feature my tips for using herbs and spices episode that I did a while back. I'll have to look up the show notes. I can't remember what episode number that was, but tell you what, you don't even need to know, because he featured that episode basically in its entirety over on the Herb Rally podcast. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes today. And if you want to go check it out, do so. Even if you've listened to that episode, you don't have to listen to me on the Herb Rally podcast. You can go check out some of the other episodes that Mason has over there. A lot of interesting folks, around herbalism, herbal healing, that sort of a thing. So if that is of interest to you, you should go check it out. He has quite a few episodes, so lots of interesting people over there. So the Herb Rally podcast. Thanks, Mason, for having my episode on herbs and spices on there. That was very cool. Speaking of herbs and spices, I usually grow some herbs here in the spring and over the summertime. I kind of get into that. And boy, I've been just having terrible luck growing anything this year. I don't know if it's the weather, although it's been a very mild summer so far here in Western Oregon. I don't know what the problem is, but not having much luck. Maybe I'm just not paying enough attention to my herbs. So maybe I need to go listen to more of the Herb Rally podcast to find out what I'm doing wrong. But one thing I do have, which is new, which is kind of cool, is a new Kamado grill, which my wife Tracy got for me for Father's Day, kind of a birthday combo and Father's Day combo gift. If you haven't ever seen these grills, I've never used one before, so this is new to me. And it's spelled K-A-M-A-D-O. That's a style of grill, not necessarily a brand name, although the one I have is called a Kamado Joe. I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that right. Probably the most famous version of this sort of consumer grill is the Big Green Egg. And even the one I have is red, but it looks like a big egg. It's basically a big ceramic egg-shaped grill, if you will. The lid opens up like you're cracking the egg, like the top third of the egg open and lifting it up. It's made of, it's a ceramic shell, coated ceramic shell. It's very thick. I think it's at least an inch thick. It might be like an inch and a half almost thick. Extremely heavy. My goodness, it was a real bear to get out of the box that it was shipped in and put together. It weighs, I think total weight is like 300 pounds or 350 or something. It's insane, whatever it is. It's really heavy. So between my wife and I, we really struggled. I mean, the different pieces aren't even that heavy. It's just like getting it out of the weird box it's packaged in. You got to like bend over and contort and, you know, lifting heavy weights like that when you're not like lifting from a position of strength. It was hard. It took us a while to get the thing together, but we finally did it. But the thing about Kamado grills, which is really cool, is they're amazing heat insulators. So because of the thick ceramic walls of the egg shape of the grill, it traps heat. It's airtight when it's sealed up, so it traps moisture as well. So it really cooks food, whether it's meats and proteins or vegetables or pizza or bread or whatever it is you're grilling in there. It really, it does it in a way I've not seen really any other grill do. I would say maybe it's somewhat like a Traeger, but it's even different than a Traeger grill. The Kamado grill uses large lump charcoal. So, you know, kind of those irregular shaped looking chunks of charcoal. They look like chunks of wood that are black, right? And it's engineered in such a way where there is an air intake on the bottom, a little slider hole in the bottom of the egg shape. And then there's a top vent that you can open wide or regulate how open you want it. And depending on how you adjust those two vents, you can really regulate the temperature in this grill. So you can actually fill up the bottom of this grill with a bunch of lump charcoal, light it. And if you crank down the airflow, you can actually grill and even smoke at very low temperatures over a very long period of time, which you really can't do with a traditional grill. So I've not done it yet, but I've read where you can keep it at like 225, 250 for 10, 11, 12 hours on a batch of lump charcoal just by regulating the airflow in this grill. So you can do a lot of low and slow smoking. On the other hand, you can crank it up and get the air flowing. And some folks can get these grills cranking at like 700 or 800 Fahrenheit. So if you want to get like a crazy hot sear on a steak, like a steakhouse, you know, level sear, or like a pizza oven type temperature, you can crank up the heat for like a high heat burn. It does all this stuff amazingly well. It's very cool. And I'm just starting to scratch the surface of learning how to use this thing. And so far I've made three things on it. I've made, the first thing I made, I just ran to the store when I finally got it put together. My wife and I got it put together. I just ran to the store and picked up a flat iron steak, grilled that up pretty traditionally. And that was excellent. Again, didn't really know what I was doing. I only had a couple pieces of the lump charcoal in there. And I read later that you're supposed to fill up the whole bottom part, just chock full of this stuff. The second night I went and I got a chicken, a whole chicken, and I spatchcocked it. So that's where you take the chicken and you cut out the backbone and then you kind of open it up and lay it flat. So it's still one piece. It's just kind of you're opening it up and laying it flat. It allows for a lot quicker cooking of a chicken. Yeah, I was able to regulate the heat and the smoke in that Kamado grill to about 250, and that chicken turned out amazing. It was probably the best chicken I've ever done on a grill. It was smoky. It was fall off the bone tender. It was juicy. I was kind of blown away with how good it was. So I was totally impressed. I'm going to be doing a lot more chicken on that. And then just this last weekend, I made some baby back ribs, and again, I was able to keep the temperature low and really give it a nice low and relatively slow smoke on those ribs, and they turned out amazing. Great smoke ring, great flavor. So I'm totally impressed with the Kamado Grill, and I don't have a lot more to say about it because I haven't used it that much yet, but I will try to put up some pictures, and when I use it a little bit more, I'll come back and share more information. But I know a lot of folks in our Facebook group have one or have used one and really speak highly of it, so I'm really looking forward to getting in and using it a whole lot more. So if you're in the market for a new grill, I will say they're not inexpensive, but they're pretty amazing from what I've seen so far. So I'll put a link to the show notes for the Kamado Joe Grill and some other Kamado Grill resources so you can check it out for yourself. And just, it's hard to explain. Once you see it, it'll make a lot more sense. And then speaking of outdoor cooking, remember back in episode 137, just a few episodes ago, I had Carl Kugler on and we talked about outdoor cooking. You know, Carl's this amazing resource. He's with a group called Grub Masters, and they have a YouTube channel with all sorts of outdoor cooking. I know my sister, for one, after listening to the podcast episode, has totally fallen in love with the Grub Master stuff. You can check out that episode at kitchencounterpodcast.com/137. But after that episode came on, I got some interesting listener feedback from a listener named Matt LaFleur up in Michigan. Now, you might remember, if you've listened to that outdoor cooking episode, at one point, Carl talks about hobo pies, where you have this like a long steel or cast iron stick, and on the end, you have like this little clamshell device, that you can enclose, put food in and close it, and then you hold it over the fire or the coals or whatever, and it cooks inside, and you can make these things called hobo pies. Anyway, Matt had some interesting feedback about that and a couple of books he wanted to share. So I'm going to read a little bit of the email that he sent me just so you can kind of see where he was coming from. So Matt said, I just finished your episode with Carl regarding outdoor cooking and have a little more insight on the outdoor pie iron. In lower Michigan, they're called hobo pies, which I think is what Carl and I referred to them as in the episode. In Michigan, they're called hobo pies, but in my native Upper Peninsula and Wisconsin, they are affectionately known as the pudgy pie. That's P-U-D-G-I-E. Pudgy pies were a fond memory for me growing up, and our family spent lots of time around a non-fire cooking pudgy pies. As an adult, I love to cook, but have very little experience camping. Pudgy pies, however, are a source of inspiration and fun for me because my wife and I host pudgy pie parties in our backyard a few times a year. That sounds like fun. The menu comes from one of my most favorite cookbook series, The Pudgy Pie Revolution. These books are exactly what you think they are. They're chock full of recipes for the most unbelievable, strange, culturally expansive, sophisticated, and most of all, fun ways of cooking outdoors. They were developed by a few college students from the University of Wisconsin and are a staple of what summer vacation means to us. What I like most about these books is that it breaks the misconception about a pudgy's foundation being white bread. They've experimented with tortillas, batters, waffles, hash browns, and more as the exterior layer of a delicious handheld. The books come complete with menu guides, how to care for your pie iron, camping tips, shopping lists, etc., etc., etc. So Matt wanted to share those books, The Pudgy Pie Revolution and its sequel, The Pudgy Revolution 2. So Matt LaFleur, thank you very much. That's awesome. And I'm so glad Carl's conversation with me resonated so much with you that you wrote me this awesome email. So that's just, I'm so happy about this. So if you're interested in the Pudgy Pie Revolution books, I'll put another link to those in the show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/140. So go check it out. You know, and if any of you other folks out there make hobo pies or pudgy pies or whatever, I'm really curious about this. I've not really dabbled much with those. I'd love to hear more. All right. Here's a little more listener feedback. This comes from JD Sutter. If that sounds familiar at all to you, a couple of summers ago, he actually, when I was out of town, he was one of the folks that actually contributed a short episode to the Kitchen Counter podcast for me. So he guest hosted an episode. back when I was doing the quick fix episodes that were like 5 or so minutes long, and he did a grape jelly mayo. So if that sounds interesting to you, I will put the link to the show notes for that episode. But here's what JD had to say just the other day. I have a topic request that I thought you might be interested in tackling. What are your tips and recipe ideas for cooking with nuts? Let me explain. I like the idea of being able to roast up some peanuts, for instance, in a skillet with a bit of oil and or spices, chop them up and add them to a dish for some extra flavor and texture. Some commonly used nuts for this are peanuts, cashews, or even pine nuts. Do you have any tips on which type of nut would best go with certain proteins, vegetables, or types of dishes? Or best methods for preparing specific nuts on a baking sheet or stovetop? What sort of fat, if any, should they be roasted in? Does it even matter? Lots of questions for you there, and I'm sure there are other ones I'm not thinking of at the moment, but I would love to hear your thoughts on the topic. Thanks. Oh, well, that's a good question, JD. I've not ever really talked about nuts specifically on the show, but you touch on some very good ideas right in your question. And actually, you hit some of the most basic points about nuts, the roasting, you know, using them for flavor and texture and things like that. So I will share some of my thoughts on cooking with nuts and seeds, at least initially here. And then as I think about it, is if I think of anything more, I will, I'll definitely circle back and maybe in a future Smorgasbord episode, bring some more recipes or ideas up. Or if any listener has information on what they like to do when it comes to cooking with nuts, definitely send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com and I will bring it up on a future episode. So nuts and seeds have a long and venerable history of being used as an ingredient in cooking, even beyond just as a garnish and a topping for, you know, extra texture or whatever. And of course, they have a long history of being used in baking as well, right? There's lots of cookies and brownies and breads and things like that, that or tarts or pies for that matter, that incorporate nuts, right? But cooking, I think it seems for a home cook, it's less obvious what you would do with nuts when it comes to cooking. Baking is kind of a no-brainer, right? You throw some chopped walnuts in your quick bread mix and bam, you're using walnuts. Well, what do you do to cook with nuts that's not just like chopping up nuts and sprinkling them on top of something? Well, like I said, nuts have a long history of being used as an important ingredient in a lot of cooking applications. One of the most famous or most common, I guess I would say, would be in various types of sauces, like a spicy African peanut sauce or a peanut sauce that might be served with a chicken satay. So peanuts and peanut butter, of course, long used for savory applications. In fact, that episode of Live Cooking I did just a few episodes back with the peanut butter rice noodle and shrimp recipe, that, you know, right there, that's a great application for using nuts or nut product in your cooking. But there's other sauces too. I mean, think of hummus or baba ganoush that uses tahini, which is ground sesame seeds, or pine nuts in a pesto sauce, or even a romesco sauce, which uses almonds. And that's just to name a few. And I know those on a vegan diet really love nuts like cashews for their ability to kind of, when they're pureed, to really mimic sort of a creamy texture. And so you can get sort of a faux cream texture in a lot of your sauces and soups and things like that by using nuts. So, you know, nuts don't just have to be chopped up and tossed on top of a salad. However, they're great like that too. And I, you know, would encourage folks to think of nuts as a garnish beyond just things like salads. I think they do offer a lot of opportunity to crank up the texture and flavor of practically any dish. And the fun thing here is that, to JD's question, you know, what nuts go with certain proteins or vegetables, it's almost impossible to pair a nut with a sort of a dish or a flavor profile where it's going to be terrible. Now, there are some affinities you might want to consider, and that goes, you know, basically to whatever the particular nut you're using tastes like, you know, what's its basic flavor profile. For example, walnuts tend to be a little bit on the bitter side, while nuts like almonds tend to be on the sweeter side, right? So there are certain qualities of different nuts that do affect a little bit of their application and what kind of food you might be pairing them with. But I can't think of very many applications where, you know, interchanging an almond for a walnut or vice versa is going to ruin a dish, unless you're going for a traditional sauce, right? If you're making a Romesco sauce, you're probably not going to be using walnuts instead of almonds. But you know what? Even if you did, it probably wouldn't be awful. So again, nuts are very versatile. Think of pasta and think of nuts as a garnish or a topping or an add-in to pasta. I mean, I can imagine a beautiful pasta with a light, maybe a light cream lemon sauce. How great would it be to chop up some pistachios and sprinkle on top? That would be fantastic, I think. So there, you know, the sky's really the limit when it comes to experimenting. So I don't really have a lot of specific recipes off the top of my head, but I do have some tips and tricks for using nuts and storing nuts that I want to go into. So probably the most important thing to keep in mind when it comes to nuts, before you even use them for food or start to prep them, is how do you store them? The trick with pretty much every nut and even seeds, but nuts especially, is they're very, very high in fat, which means that they will not keep indefinitely. And in fact, if you're not careful, you're going to have nuts that are going to go rancid. And if you use rancid nuts in any application, whether it's baking or, you know, putting in a sauce or using as a garnish or just an add-on a salad or whatever, it's basically going to ruin whatever it is you're using those rancid nuts with. So because of the high fat content, nuts tend to go rancid. I don't want to say fairly quickly, but they will go. And if you're ever in doubt, you just need to take a little nibble if the smell doesn't give it away, and you'll know if they're no good. But to that end, it's always best to store your nuts in an airtight container, preferably in a cool place. A dark place doesn't hurt either. You can even store your nuts in the refrigerator. And, you know, you can put nuts in the fridge in an airtight container, and those will probably last 3 or 4 months. You can even freeze nuts in airtight containers, and you'll get a couple extra months, even more, 5-6 months out of them in the freezer. And that goes for shelled nuts, right? So you're already buying them in the bag, or you're buying them in bulk or in jars or whatever shelled. They've been removed from their shell. If you buy nuts that are unshelled, that are still in their shell, they'll last even longer. Of course, then you have to deal with the task of shelling all of those nuts when you want to go to use them, right? So it's a trade-off. Personally, I rarely buy unshelled nuts just because of the hassle. You know, I use them up fast enough that them going bad and going rancid isn't really a concern of mine. But I will tell you, I have stumbled across, you know, you can buy like the bags of nuts in the baking aisle in the grocery store, right? Like the chopped walnuts and whatever. I have run into bags of those that we've had in the pantry that I've forgotten about. Woo-wee, and they are gnarly. So definitely be careful about those nuts going rancid. Now, suppose you have not rancid nuts, as ridiculous as that sounds to say. You've got nuts that you want to use. Typically, when you buy nuts in the store, if they're shelled, they're either going to come raw or they're going to come either dry roasted, roasted with oil or some other preparation like honey roasted or seasoned or something like that. For me, generally, I like to buy the unseasoned raw versions. And if you're doing that, I always recommend almost 100% of the time, whatever you're using them for, to give them a toast or a roast before you use them, because it's going to do a couple of things. It's going to crank up the flavor on those nuts, and it's going to let them keep a little bit more of their crunch when you're cooking with them. So because nuts are so high in fat, they have a tendency, especially the really high fat nuts like pecans and cashews and walnuts, to get a little bit soggy if they're used in sort of a moist application. So by toasting them or roasting them beforehand, it helps combat that just a little bit. Now, for me, the vast majority of the time, if I'm going to be toasting up some nuts, I do it without oil, and I do it on the stovetop in a skillet. And for me, what I do is I get a big enough skillet for however many nuts I want to use, because when you put the nuts in the skillet, you want them to be in a single layer, right? You don't want to pile them up. You want them all to be making contact with the bottom of your pan, your skillet. I tend to leave them whole if I can, before I don't chop them up before I roast them. And I simply put the burner on medium to medium high heat. And you have to keep an eye on the nuts when you're doing them on the stovetop like that, because you're going to want to turn them or shake them fairly frequently. You don't want them to burn. But, you know, in 6, 7, 8 minutes, you're going to have nuts that are going to start to brown a little bit, and you'll smell the aroma. You'll see the color. And then, you know, don't let them burn, and pull them off the burner, let them cool down, and then you're ready to use them in whatever application you're going to use. You could do the same thing in the oven on a cookie sheet in a single layer at like 300 degrees. Less likely to let them get away from you and burn as you would on the stovetop, but you still do have to keep an eye on them for a little bit. And it just depends on how toasted you want them. You're going to want to check them every seven, you know, maybe starting at 7 or 8 minutes, and then, you know, turning them and checking them every few minutes thereafter until they get toasted like you want them. Now, the only time I would ever toast or roast with an oil or a fat of some sort, to JD's question, is if I wanted to season the nuts somehow or add spices to them, or candy them or something like that. So like if you want to put spices on the nuts that you're toasting up, the spice won't adhere to dry, toasted, roasted nuts, right? You've got to have a little bit of oil for the spices to stick. So that's about the only time I would probably use fat while I'm roasting or toasting up any nuts or seeds. Also, when you're chopping up nuts like walnuts or pecans or cashews or whatever, I really recommend that you do it by hand with a knife and a cutting board rather than throwing them in a food processor or a blender. Unless you're making a paste or a butter or you're trying to puree the nuts or the seeds, you're going to end up with a inconsistent product if you use a machine to do it. You're going to end up, if you throw them in a food processor, for example, you're going to end up with some that remain in huge, big, huge chunks, and then you're going to end up with some of the nuts or seeds that are going to basically turn to powder, and then you're going to have everywhere in between. If you use a knife and you do it by hand, you get a lot more consistent size, and you're not going to end up with the powdery bits or the big oversized chunks. And so I would recommend chopping and working with your seeds or your nuts by hand with a knife. Let me see what else to say about that. I found a few links with some information on pairing and recipes and sauces and things like that that use seeds or nuts. So I will put some links to those over in the show notes so you can check those out. I know that wasn't a real comprehensive survey of using nuts or seeds in cooking, but those are kind of some off the top thoughts on that. So JD, I hope that helped a little bit. Again, if any of you have some experience or ideas or information you want to share, send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. All right, everybody. Well, that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. I really, really appreciate it. Once again, the show notes for this episode are over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/140. If you want to get in touch with me, if you have a question you want me to cover on a future episode, or if you have a topic idea, again, feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com is perfect. And if you want to interact with the group of us, head over to our Facebook group at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. All right. Well, that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. You know, I really, really do appreciate you tuning in and taking time to listen to the show. And I really, really appreciate you telling your friends and your family about the show. And I really, really appreciate you going over to iTunes or Apple Podcasts rather, or wherever you download this show and leaving a rating and a review if they accept it. It really does help out the show, and I really do appreciate it. All right, everybody, thank you so much one more time for spending some time with me today. Until next time, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.